Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast. Excellent. So, Sam, welcome. Good to have you on.
Nick, thank you very much indeed for having me.
Good. And let's introduce you a little bit. So the easy thing, I guess a lot of people say with you, is the author of Be More Pirate. But how would you introduce yourself?
I'm a very happy hybrid of a pirate, scientist, author, and entrepreneur. And I very much enjoy my ability to take on and take off those hats without ever feeling like a charlatan, because one of the skills I've most enjoyed in my life is being multilingual. And I've been able to work in prisons with complete connection and trust with some of the most innovative entrepreneurs I've ever met, as much as I have been able to advise prime ministers, to coach C-suites, to start businesses, to run programs in townships and favelas. And somehow between my various experiences, that ability to be able to hold space and authenticity in so many different environments and to be able to converse so deeply with people at the highest and at the lowest, that doesn't sound that fair, but you know, the aspects of society is probably the thing that I'm proudest of.
Right, yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I guess the other side of that is sometimes there are people who do lots of different things, but they all stem from the same thing. And that sense of adventure you talked through, that sort of feel, that's what it comes from. It's like these are interesting adventures that you're on. So it comes from the same place inside you, do you think?
I think so, yeah. The notion that life's an adventure.
So let's lead into that. So what does being more pirate mean to you?
Being more pirate is about having a sense of agency in a world that very often feels like it is designed against us, or a world that has a default setting towards a no or a negative. And rather than tolerate the bureaucracy that binds us and the complacency that trips us, rather than allow the notion of rule breaking be considered some kind of risky or irresponsible thing to do, being more pirate says hell no. Quite often, breaking the rules or taking the rules into your own accountability set becomes the responsible thing to do, and one of the few remaining levers to actually get something meaningful done.
It's interesting. That cuts across so many different things. Actually, it's interesting because lots of the people who quite often get given the task of making a change happen come in some sense from more of a compliance background. So you're kind of working inside the system in the way it's supposed to be. But then quite often the change makers are the people that end up in the system by accident or something.
I had started Be More Pirate. I ran Liverty, this agency, which was around social innovation and change, giving young people a platform to absolutely transform their lives. And we did so by working with them as a catalyst for organizations who were also seeking change. When you smash two different drivers of change together, something really powerful and profound happened. But even then, even when I actually had a career in innovation, there was so much stagnation. There was so much bullshit. There were so many post-it notes where good ideas get written on the walls and then sent off to die, you know, where brilliant ideas happen in wonderful sessions where people have the nerve to step outside their traditional comfort zones. And then those ideas were transported to PowerPoint slides or email threads and, you know, sent off to be to their death. Being more pirate was a love letter to taking some risks about really how change can be emergent, how change has to, you know, have a embryonic aspect to it, and how often change is just another name given to something that we already did before. And I felt like it needed a degree of dynamism and agency to do that. And I thought we were lacking the real role models. And when we looked to history, like the greatest aspects of change, the stuff that we really, you know, civil rights, suffragettes, you know, the stuff where, like, let's really lean towards large-scale change, because we're at a moment in time when much less is probably a little bit wider the brief. And in seeking role models that weren't well understood or perhaps offered a dynamism that we don't necessarily have, pirates emerged. You know, it's a little known and not very well understood aspect of history. But through my lens, if you truly look at the history of social innovation, which has a direct relationship with the English working class from the kind of levelers to the Chartists right through to the suffragettes, trade unions, the cooperatives, and then the fight of an eventual kind of victory of workers' rights, pirates sit and exist squarely on that trajectory.
It's interesting. That book, I'm not sure it's something you'll be conscious of. I'm most conscious that there's certain books people love and there's certain books that people just take around with them almost as like a license or a reminder that book exists. And the way I encountered that book for the first time was you start to see people come into a meeting and they'd have a little pile of stuff. And one of the books that would be there would be Be More Pirate. I think people used it as a kind of confirmation that it was okay to think like that. It was okay to be like that because you'd written it. You'd put it in a book. I don't know if you're conscious of that, but it did inspire a lot of people to do a lot of things, I think.
How wonderful. No, I've never thought about it like that. I have a slightly imposter syndrome relationship with it. I get on stage or be introduced as the best-selling author and I kind of look over my shoulder and say, oh, I'd quite like to meet a best-selling author. I can say that I wrote a sequel book to try to come to terms with the original book's success and did over 100 interviews with organizations large and small, charity, public sector, NGOs, private sector, commercial, you know, global firms. Why did this work? Why did this create change when so many other programs that put on the same lever haven't? And the word that came out most for me was permission. There is something about being a pirate that gave proxy proxy is the best word for it. So permission that other people didn't otherwise think they could have. And you know what? The dynamism in there was something to do with fun. There was something about this that gave license to exactly that moment. This is a badge. This is a flag. This is a tattoo. This is a signal, a symbol that says I'm going to do something a little bit different. And there are so many tropes that we know, you know, the old seek forgiveness rather than permission. These things that we'll say, but there was something about that little pink book that emboldened people to actually do it. And that was the difference. It didn't take much because the second that you do, the second that you accept or admit that the tiny rules that get in the way, the no's that we acquiesce to, when you do finally just step into the power to push through them, you realize those walls are paper thin, you know, and you realize all of a sudden you've got more control than you thought you did. And that is intoxicating and very often quite empowering. So I can see retrospectively why it meant so much to so many people, although I didn't necessarily predict that when I wrote it.
And do you think that kind of permission is something that, you know, clearly some people are wanting and connect to? There's some people that are, you know, naturally have that sense of adventure that you have, that you give them permission and then they can go to the next level. Do you think there's certain people that are like that and certain people that's less relevant for? Or do you think there's certain people that actually never have the inclination to be a pirate and should never try?
There was a journey of discovery. The first book I wrote was the most boring book on earth. I got 20,000 words into a book called Purpose First, and it was the argument for why, you know, the revolution we need is an organizational shift towards values and purpose. But that's before the word purpose has become so diluted. But it was also in retrospect, it was my evolution from being an entrepreneur to being a grown-up, and I was leaving Liberty, which I'd started in my early 20s, and I'd always said I'd leave when I was too old because it was an organization dedicated to young people, and I'd set that as 40 because when you're 20-something, 40 seems like the end of the world. And as 40 rolled around, I had to do something, and as a dyslexic non-academic, I thought the scariest thing I could do would be write a book, and I felt very deeply frustrated that having arrived now in ministerial circles, in C-suites, in the organizations that I'd always dreamed of working with, and realized that they didn't have a plan and that they didn't have any more chance of creating change than anyone I'd ever met. So we needed to do something a bit more drastic. Yes, there absolutely had to be some kind of like something that would push us over the edge. And it was in there that spirit of piracy, like, got me. You know, just purpose on its own won't be enough. There's got to be a greater catalyst that's going to get us over the edge. And then all of a sudden, when it did, you're like, oh, you see this kind of leaning into it, because it wasn't for the first group I thought it was for, the people like me, the entrepreneurs and the mavericks or the frustrated individuals who passionately believe in this, but you know, they're working to it. It was the people who work in the Navy. It was the people who are in organizations that want to make change but don't. And the book has taught me that it's easy to make, but a huge mistake to not appreciate how many people are walking around just two steps behind the limiting beliefs that they hold so close. And all of us in so many ways are reaching towards something that we want to do or we've been thinking about or that drives us mad in our desire for it, but we just stop short all of the time. And it's in that bit, that's why I think why I think for so many people it's felt so essential, because innovation sounds so big, right? Creating the change in the world sounds so big, but we're actually so close to these limiting beliefs that we're all walking around with in our pockets all the time. And just getting someone to walk through that is one of the biggest things you can do.
I'd love to just pick up slightly on the liberty thing, interestingly, because actually it's interesting. So that's, you know, that other part to your work in life, I guess, in terms of youth culture and a focus on youth culture and helping people understand youth culture. And to some degree, some people might be listening to this thinking, my God, everyone's obsessed with youth culture. Like, brands are obsessed with young people. You know, why was there a need for somebody to get beyond the kind of focus groups and the way everyone does things? Do you think there is something that holds people back from understanding youth culture more fully?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think that I observed that lots of people were very obsessed, like you say, about youth culture, but they were very scared of young people. And that's a difficult paradox. Brands who work with young people and agencies who sell youth insights and, you know, all manner of charities, you know, delivering programs to young people and the Minister for Children. Few and far between in them, in my experience at that time, had any direct or daily interaction with young people themselves. I mean, they'd be surprised when we'd suggest they might want to meet some of the kids, you know, and then when they did, they'd often meet the kind of polished version. They were almost professionalized young people who go from charity to charity and appear in all the posters and they know exactly what to say. And of course, it's a sensitive area. But Liberty was different. We had a big warehouse in the middle of Brixton. And a metric of success for us was when the grown-ups were outnumbered by young people, and this energy crackled around the room when all of a sudden there was 100 teenagers in this huge space. And, you know, partly because the bloody music changed and volume changed, and it was our intention to make sure a very large number of those young people were not served by mainstream support services, so they would have their hoods up and their jeans down and their, you know, their backgrounds and their nicknames and everything might come across scary. But by George, like, again and again, those were some of the most innovative, interesting, charming, eloquent, forward-thinking young people that you ever met, because there was definitely a correlation between survival skills and entrepreneurial skills, between creativity and opportunism. And when you put those young people into a room with kids in mainstream education, kids who are entrepreneurs, kids who've been refugees, and smart, creative professionals and clients with opportunities, the melting pot that occurred, the chemistry that came out of that was absolutely incredible. And in simplest terms, the formula was naivety meets wisdom. And when that happened, like, it crackled off of it. And it's why Liberty, you know, we won Agency of the Year again and again. We won Campaign of the Year. We won Business of the Year. We could take on agencies 100 times our size and power and clout and win, because to answer the question, we weren't relying on trend reports or insights. We would literally put kids into the pitch process and they would come to the pitch with us. And when we were feeling really ballsy, we would put young people on the client side of the table to judge us, because we knew the client didn't have a clear enough understanding of youth insights. So we'd show up with young people to speak on the client's behalf. And young people are very, very good at being very, very honest. And it really, yeah, it was one of the most glorious times of my life. And I still reflect that, even though we tried to create and did create opportunities for tens of thousands of young people, I never gave away more than I got. You know, it was definitely one of the most informative periods of my life.
Really interesting. Now, there's a couple of words. It's interesting. So when our producers were getting to know you through the Label Sessions process, and it's interesting that they flagged, there's a couple of words that come up a lot when they speak to you, they don't come up, but some leaders when we speak to them. And it's interesting you brought them up already in this conversation as well. So it's interesting just to speak to you around some of those words.
Is it swear words?
Yeah. Well, one of them is authentic. And it's interesting, what does authenticity mean to you and why do you think it's so important?
I think authenticity is probably a question of identity. And I think identity is one of the big debates of our time. I think we're largely in a crisis of identity, and that's played out on all manner of fields, probably particularly pointed at by how charged even that very word is. I imagine quite a lot of people would avoid using the word at the moment for fear of being cancelled or treading on areas or feeling it's too sensitive. But who the fuck are you in this time of such great change, when what mattered no longer seems to matter and where no one has quite a clear handle on where it's going? And it's easy to feel a bit adrift if one doesn't know who one is, and there's an awful lot to be done. And so authenticity, to me, speaks to an understanding of who you are. I think that's what's interesting. To the point I said earlier on, you know, told to be yourself, and that's an easy thing, sounds easy to do, but not so much if you don't know who you are. So I'm very interested in that exploration of who we are. And once I get into that, I think it becomes the very important question. I think it's also unanswerable. But the notion of finding yourself is a mad, naive luxury that is a fool's errand at the same time. But I think it's a deeply important question. There's a well-known book, The Regrets of the Dying. And there are five key regrets that thousands upon thousands of people who've been interviewed at the moment of their death repeat the same things. And they're very poignant, but they're also kind of basic. And I say that with respect to the work that's been done and the tragedy of anyone who's losing anyone. But they're traveling, they're being yourself, they're time with friends and family. And I looked at the list and I thought, well, if I'd achieved all of those and I wasn't going to go out with one of those being my regrets, what would it be? And it would be in there. It would be that sense of being truly aware of who you were. Like, I would not like to leave this earth not having known who I, you know, not having known myself, not having been my own favorite person. Who is their own favorite person, right? But also, the only relationship really that ultimately truly matters in your life is the one that you have with yourself. And very few of us have a very good relationship with ourselves. Who do you know that loves themselves ideally, clearly and openly? And that sounds really icky and awful. What a shit thing to do. But strip it all away and probably what else is there? Like, really? And so that kind of thought fascinates me. And so I'm probably a little bit uncomfortably transparent about my investigation of this question. But I find it more accountable to be transparent about it, more useful to be transparent about it. And I have empirical evidence to know well enough that transparency of the investigation has been so useful to many others, and particularly in my work in leadership. I think it becomes profoundly important, and I'm able to get leaders doing things that they wouldn't dream of doing because there's a currency around authenticity. People trust me, and they're all linked.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because even anecdotally, it's funny because I think quite often in the field of leadership, which has become quite technical in some ways, and people have very complicated models, but there is certainly something in terms of leaders that are comfortable with themselves, other people are sort of attracted to, and those that aren't kind of generate this kind of stress around themselves or this kind of something negative around themselves anyway.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of models, but I think there's extrinsic and intrinsic leadership, and I'm not talking about extrinsic leadership. I'm talking about what's happening inside you and your ability to make a decision to do the right thing, your ability to get out of the house, your ability to, you know, tell the truth, your ability to, you know, leadership, I don't think is, you know, being an MD is a job. Being a leader is something that's not a job. You don't get gifted or graduated into being a leader. It's something that you earn or something that you create or something that you evolve into, probably.
Interesting. And then the other word that comes up a lot, which some people would see as a scary word, and it feels like it's more quite at the center of the way you operate, which is uncertainty. You seem to sort of embrace that uncertainty. Is that fair?
It's one of my favorite words.
But you'd agree, there's a lot of people we know who'd be very scared of it.
I mean, everyone you know is scared of it. The fundamental human fear, and this is well documented, is the unknown. And that's because for our survival as a species, there are four considerations. One is social groups, and that's got easier over the last 300,000 years. One is shelter. That's also got easier over the last 300,000 years. And one is sustenance. That's also got easier for most people. And then there's survival. And survival is directly linked to uncertainty as a threat response. And that's not something that we can cognitively choose to do. That is something that happens at a nervous system level well beyond most of our conscious control. And at a ratio of about 9 to 1, we will avoid anything remotely unknown to stay alive. And that is an operating system that requires a little bit of an upgrade in the world that we live in, because the triggers that would make us move away from something as it might be a risk to our survival are no longer saber-toothed tigers, but notifications and doom-scrolling and the news and the tragedy in Gaza or in Kiev or in Central Africa or wherever it might be right now or in the future. And so we're persistently on a system of high alert that was meant for short-term use is now being exhausted, and therefore it becomes exhausting. So uncertainty is, in my opinion, both the meta threat of leadership and anybody in the current age, but also, luckily, not just a thing that needs to be mitigated, but an opportunity that needs to be liberated, because there is nothing but nothing that brings out the best of humanity than a moment of uncertainty. And we don't like that truth, but it is damn well true. And think of anybody you know or yourself. What are your two proudest stories? What are the things that you tell for the 100th time when you've had a pint, you know, or the stories you want told at your wedding or your funeral? They're rarely the most predictable things that happen in your life, are they? They're when something happened against the odds, when the chances were great, you know, when things could have gone wrong. Retrospectively, we deeply love uncertainty and our relationship with it, much like the axiomatic truth that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. In reverse, through the back window, yeah. But no one looks at a shit show ahead of them and thinks, brilliant, here's my chance to get stronger. And it's in there. Uncertainty is not the problem. Uncertainty is our great opportunity. Our relationship with uncertainty is the gateway to, and I honestly think, some of the novel thinking that we're all shy of and typically step away from. Just at the point when we're reaching for something genuinely new, our compulsion becomes to reach for the known instead. And we all know it. At that just moment, don't give me the familiar, even if it sucks. No, I'll vote for those dickheads, even though they're promising me some old tripe that I know they can't deliver. No, I'll just take it. We all know the feeling. I think it's because we're all scared of failure. Like that's our greatest fear. That's everyone who might listen to this. All of their greatest fear is a fear of failure. But secretly, I think we all fear success more. And that's the power of uncertainty.
So there's one final serious question, then again, some fun ones to round off. But
fun? I thought this was all been fun.
Well, exactly. We are really fun in a minute. So I don't want to say your expectations are too high, but it gets even more fun later on. But
my expectations of fun are pretty high.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm really excited about you joining, because I think that one of the, the clients self-select a little bit on Label Sessions. So they're all people who are about to try and make something big happen. So they have to go and they're about to go and launch a new brand somewhere or launch a new product or solve some big problem someone else hasn't taken before. And they self-select because Label Sessions clients have chosen not to go to McKinsey or Deloitte for that, but to go into our crazy world of really interested people to help them. You think about that situation someone's quite often in when you're about to start this new thing. So you've embraced the uncertainty to that extent, but you're surrounded by some extent of institutional no. There's lots of people around you who tell you it's a stupid thing to start or a thing you shouldn't take on, or there's a different project that'll be a bit safer for your career. What are some of the things you should have in mind as to how to take on this next step and succeed, or at least, you know, put yourself in the best place to succeed as a result?
A thoughtful question. Thank you. I think I've got two answers to that. The first is, I've recently been asking a question. In a moment of uncertainty, would you prefer to be seen as decisive, even if you knew that it would lead to a negative outcome, or indecisive if you knew that it would lead to a positive outcome? And I don't provide a definition of negative or positive, but let's assume people interpret that as money, stress, time. 70% of people, and I've asked this of over 4,000 people, choose decisive. I'd rather be seen as decisive, knowing full well that will lead to a negative outcome. And I don't think that's surprising. I don't think anyone will be surprised that that's the outcome, even though That is us putting our short-term reputation ahead of the success. And so in this moment of a label session client with a brand new opportunity, and I'm going to bring this thing into the world, it is more important to most of the people that they be seen in a certain way than it is for this thing to succeed in moments of uncertainty, because we cling to these false certainties. Psychologically, they're known as safety behaviors. Things get uncertain, we all move for safety behaviors. It's kind of a fake safe. So a personal fake safe might be, shit, things have got a bit out of whack. I'm going to like neck a few glasses of wine, or I'm going to doom scroll for an hour, or I'm going to just start a fight because at least in a fight, I'm in control. At work, it's worse. I'm going to just pitch an idea I've said 100 times, even though I know it's a bit of shit. I'm going to just start a few meetings because I know how to run a meeting. I'm going to CC a few more people on this email because like I'll cover my back. So just in those exact moments, it's the known versus the novel again. And when you extrapolate the data out, and I just pull out the leadership group, it goes up to about 90%. And this is very important. Current leadership exists on a paradigm that no longer seems relevant. The classic INSEAD MBA, you know, your point to the McKinsey style director. Of course, there's brilliant, wonderful people in those firms, but they are so wedded to a discipline and a type and an approach, and their clients expect a response. You can imagine them all falling foul. They would all probably be in the 90%. I'd prefer to be seen as decisive. And this is the opportunity, the second point. I think the current paradigm of leadership in a world which values authenticity and needs to, because the currency of leadership must be trust. Must be. And the problem, therefore, is in a world where, as Satya Nadella said, it is impossible to expect anyone to know it all now. How the fuck do you say the truth as a leader to most questions, which is, I don't know? Most things that we've looked, so there are four types of problems, right? You know, from the classic problem all the way to a wicked problem. I think there's five now. I think there's the problems that are no longer problems. They're just paradoxes. There's no clear answer. And your job as a leader is to be able to say, I don't know, in an inspiring and compelling and really motivating and reassuring way. And that, riddle me that, Batman. That doesn't exist. And have you ever met a team who really, really wants to hear, I don't know, yeah, thanks, boss. And that, I think, is the paradigm of leadership right now. How do you maintain authenticity and trust and not knowing all at once? And I have a suggestion to get started, which is, I don't know, trust is gained, authenticity is gained. This is crazy and we are facing paradoxes, but I know that we can work it out together. So we move to collaboration and curiosity as the key values for a team navigating in complex and ambiguous circumstances, because the falsehood, the 90%, is still valuing certainty and confidence. And I think there's still lots of value in certainty and confidence. Of course, I want it from my leaders, but currently I know they're lying. And so give me curiosity and collaboration and let's work it out together.
There's so much more I'd love to talk about with this, but I'm going to have to sort of draw this together and then go into the fun questions, which weirdly, because of the way the fun questions have been selected for you, Sam, have a weird segue. Because the first weird rapid fire question is, imagine, I mean, it's a little known power that you didn't know I had, Sam, but we just made you a benevolent dictator of the United Kingdom. What's your first order?
If it rains on a bank holiday, it becomes a rollover to the following Monday.
That's a great rule. That's good. Okay, that's good. It would raise the stakes of the weather forecast, which is I'd enjoy a lot. So the next one is, what are the three things that you cannot live without?
My wife, who's my also partner in so many things in crime. She's the safest place I know. She makes me able to believe in myself. She's the best mind I've ever met. She wakes up excited by ideas. It's very annoying. But we have a promise to each other about facing play and problems equally. And yeah, she's changed my life, and I shall be with her till the end of the universe. And it's a glorious thing to feel that connected to a human being. The ability to write is how I think. And I love the surprise of writing and then waking up in the next day and discovering whether it was good or bad. And it's a total surprise. And the connection that words, written words have, there'll never be anything, I think, that matches that as a transference of power and connectivity and ideas. What's the third thing? It should be something fun, shouldn't it? Because those are both a bit bloody unfun. I've really killed the fun.
Well, I'm out of focus, but furious fun. But it's, you know, you had all the power of being the dictator a minute ago, so it's easy
I've
to
get. I've killed the fun stuff. Psychedelics. So magic mushrooms. I'm a big believer in both the recreational and the occasional internal use of a bit of mushroom tea. And I've had some of my best ideas and personal kind of updates in those moments.
And then the final one is, on a scale of 1 to 10, we ask everyone this, on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you?
Fucking weirder than 1 to 10 will ever allow for.
It reveals a lot of the immediate answer, you know, like, most people do come up with a number, but like, that's breaking out the system entirely is also a good response, I think. You know.
Can't put my weirdness in a 1 to 10 scale.
I always think as well, but the weirdest way to answer is actually 1. Because like everyone's weirdness has come out over the last half hour of a podcast. Like, there's no point hiding it, you know.
Yeah. I'm on more of a spectrum between unicorn to kettle. Like, there's something there.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.